Please be seated. Is there a God, or has the idea just been invented by humans, either looking for comfort themselves or seeking to oppress others? That's a question which has prompted a lot of deep thought, both for and against. Although it also needs to be said, there are some pretty daft things said on both sides. A statue of Jesus was reported as having water mysteriously dripping from its toes. Worshippers would collect it and sometimes drink it, seeing it as a miracle giving solid proof of their faith. The source of the water was later found to be a nearby clogged toilet. On the other side of the argument, you can get a t-shirt which proclaims, "I think, therefore I am an atheist," conveniently ignoring the fact that, though it's true there are some very deep-thinking atheists, there have also been quite a few believers who, by anyone's standards, have been considerable thinkers. The Apostle Paul, St. Augustine, Isaac Newton, and also, ironically, the philosopher who came up with the famous principle from which those words were adapted, "I think, therefore I am," because René Descartes was a devout Catholic. And therefore, as I tackle the question today of why I and many other Christians believe in God, I want to try and avoid the impression that I can give you in the next few minutes 27 rock-solid, indisputable proofs for God's existence, which only an idiot could disagree with. It's just not as simple as that. The two main sets of thoughts that encourage me to believe in God, that lead me to persevere in my faith, even when it's severely challenged, are, first of all, reflecting on the world we see around us, and secondly, considering the Christian claim that God has chosen to communicate to his world, and supremely, through sending his Son, Jesus Christ. So first, the way the world around is seen by me and many others to be best explained by its having been created by a personal, powerful God. That's a thought that's been around for a long time, as is witnessed by the Bible readings we heard earlier. My focus today springs from the opening lines from the first of those, Psalm 19 from the Old Testament. "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork." Those words are written by someone speaking on a very emotional level, written before telescopes were invented, let alone anyone had any idea that the sun and stars were great balls of burning gases. And yet the writer sensed intuitively the wonder of what was seen up above on a clear night points to the wonder of the God whose handiwork this represents. And I believe that many still share that intuitive conviction today, not only looking up the stars, but for many, looking at the beauty of the world around us. You might think that now we know far more about the universe, this way of thinking is redundant, that everything around us is entirely explained as an accidental and meaningless assortment of debris that arose from the Big Bang. But over the last 50 years or so, there's been an awareness that the universe contains many fine balances without which life as we know it wouldn't be possible, without which you and I wouldn't be possible. To begin with, the orbit of the Earth is in just the right place. If it was slightly closer to the Sun, it would be too hot for life to exist. If it were just a bit further away, it would be too cold for organic life to be possible. The orbit of the Earth is just right. And there are many other aspects of the composition of the universe and the laws of physics, which also appear to be finely tuned in a similar way to the most extraordinary degree. The particular energy levels in carbon and oxygen, for example, make possible the fact there's lots of carbon in the universe, which is pretty important for you and for me because we're made of the stuff. The rate at which the universe is expanding too, turns out to give a stable environment over the kind of time frame that enables life on Earth to develop and thrive. These and many, many other similar observations have sometimes been described as the Goldilocks principle. You will know the story. Goldilocks enters the three bears' cottage. Mummy and Daddy Bear's porridge are in turn too hot and too cold, but Baby Bear's is just right. So that's the one she polishes off. Mummy and Daddy Bear's chairs are respectively too hard and too soft, whilst Baby Bear's chair seemed at first just right. So that's the one Goldilocks ends up on, although eventually she breaks it. Finally, Goldilocks, when she wants a nap, maybe prompted by the carbs in the porridge she ate, for similar reasons, it's a Baby Bear's bed that feels just right. And that's where she's found sleeping when the three bears return home. Well, in the same kind of way, the universe, the laws of physics, appear to be just right for us to exist, leading to significant speculation about how things have come about in that way. Some say it's just one of those things. To them, no further explanation is required. Others speculate that whatever properties the universe happened to possess, some kind of self-replicating chemistry that could be called life could have developed somewhere within it. Quite a few, though, see that as extremely unlikely. For some, the only recourse is to propose that there are an infinite number of other universes not yet observable to us, which makes it far less surprising that one of the many universes, ours, should enable life to develop. That, though, if you think about it, represents quite a significant leap of faith in something that can't be seen. And as a believer, I feel it's far less of a leap of faith to say that maybe all this simply points to a personal creator who deliberately chose to arrange the universe so that a part of it was just right for life to develop. It's not solid proof of God's existence, but it seems to me to be the most obvious way of explaining what we see. There's a similar line of thinking that for me is very persuasive in regard to the wonder of human life. Whether we've just done basic secondary school science or maybe A-levels or perhaps got university degrees in biology, we will all at different levels be familiar with the theory of evolution, that each new life can be explained as being the end product of 4 billions of years of entirely chance events. For many people, though, when they become parents, they don't necessarily discount all that, but there's an intuitive sense that there must be some greater being behind that wonderful process. And then as a child grows and develops their own personality, their own will, and the child's own sense of consciousness becomes clearly apparent too. Again, an approach that looks only at the atoms and the chemicals and the DNA that makes up our genes seems to many completely inadequate to explain the wonder of human life. Unable to provide a solid reason why concepts like love matter so much to us, why we have such deep-seated convictions that there are right ways to behave and wrong ways to behave. Now, philosophers who don't believe in God have attempted to explain what these things might be about, and I don't want to belittle their attempts. But in the end, it seems to me that by far the simplest explanation, by far the most credible explanation as to why these things matter so much to us, is that we're made by a God of love, a conscious being who determines that some ways of living are bad and others are good. And even if what I've said so far doesn't entirely convince, even if it only makes a person open to the possibility that there might be a God, well, just a small openness to that possibility makes a huge difference about what our reaction might be if we're willing to open the Bible, if we're willing to read the reports of Jesus' life and death and its claims about his miracles and his resurrection. You see, if you start looking at the Bible absolutely convinced in your own mind that there isn't a God, that this universe is all there is, then when you read of claims of miracles or of someone who's purported to have a message from God, well, occasionally a convinced atheist is converted by what they read. It's not all that common, though, because if you start with that presupposition, you will find some other explanation of the facts. The author of Sherlock Holmes had the master detective explain his methodology. Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. If you start off certain that miracles and God communicating is impossible, you won't be too troubled, even if the alternative explanation seems a bit improbable, even if it seems very unlikely, you will most likely not consider the Bible's claim too seriously. But if what I've said up to now reminds you that maybe there's an idea that there's a God, is at least a possibility, perhaps in some people's minds, quite a strong possibility, then I believe that to read the Bible, and especially one of the four Gospels describing Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, can be a life-transforming experience. For if there's a God who made us and whose nature is love, then the claim that this God is choosing in Christ to come to our world in person makes a lot of sense. If our world bears the hallmark of having been made by a God who is all-powerful, yet at the same time contains the flaws and the problems that most of us find deeply troubling, well, to hear that Jesus has been sent as our saviour to in some way begin to sort things out is a claim that's well worth considering. A few years ago, most people had encountered a proportion of the Bible's account of Jesus' teaching at school or Sunday school, and the challenge I'd make was that it could be important to read a gospel account of Jesus' life for the first time as an adult to try and decide what you make of his claims for yourself. These days, a good many may be coming to the Gospels with only the sketchiest awareness from their upbringing about how Jesus is described, which I believe makes it even more important to judge for yourself what you make of the portraits that Jesus' own disciples and the immediately following generation of believers wrote about him. If you'd like to do that with others, do speak to me. It only needs two or three people to want to find out more together, and I'd be delighted to put on a little course, or I'm happy to speak to individuals one-to-one as well. Or maybe you've got a friend who's a strong believer who you can talk to about things. If it turns out that there isn't a God, well, it would be no big deal to have never really considered the possibility that he might be there. If there was, I and many others believe, the God who made us isn't merely a distant, uninterested being, but one who loves us and who longs to get to know us. Well, even if you think that's just one of many possibilities, then exploring Christian claims about that God and about Jesus surely becomes a top priority for every single one of us.
Consider some of those things we've just heard together and to ask each other where we stand on some